today I'm here with David Troy. He runs 410 Labs. He's based out of Baltimore. And David and I met in China and Japan. We went on the very, very first Geeks on a Plane trip many years ago. Not many years ago, but a few years ago. And we haven't actually spoken since then, and now here he is on an interview. So, David, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Adrian. Glad to be here.
So tell us a little bit about who you are and what you've been up to.
Yeah, so, you know, I'm kind of a geek technology entrepreneur based in Baltimore, Maryland. Kind of been a serial entrepreneur since I was a teenager. And my latest company is called 410 Labs. And we founded the company, my partner and I, partner Matt Cole, back in 2010, around the idea of really looking for interesting ideas that could be made into products. We're both, you know, kind of information signal to noise is kind of our passion. So we wanted to find some interesting products in that space and set out to kind of develop three different ideas that we had been working on, one of which is called Replies, which helps people get answers to questions that they are might not otherwise get answers to using things like Twitter. And then the other is called Shortmail, which is kind of a short messaging service that's based on email. And then the latest one that we're spending a lot of time on and just getting a lot of traction is called Maelstrom. Basically, it enables people to better handle large volumes of email. It's sort of a machete or a machine gun for going into a big overgrown mailbox.
So in the past, you did something, and I've forgotten what it was, but you did something on Twitter that got quite a lot of traction.
Yeah, so back in the very early days of Twitter, I was one of the first people to develop something, actually the first person, at least if you ask Jack and Biz and Ev and those guys, to develop something using the Twitter API, and that was called Twitter Vision. And it was a really kind of a visualization of all of the traffic that was happening on Twitter at that time. And at that time, it was a relatively small amount of volume, so you could actually see all the tweets happening all around the world on a map in real time, which was kind of gave people an early sense of kind of what the possibility of Twitter might be. And it was used in a lot of news reports and whatnot about Twitter at that time to help explain the concept. So as part of that, I got kind of friendly with the Twitter team and got really bit by the bug of wanting to build products and things, on the internet. I had been mostly involved in telecommunications and internet service provider type stuff prior to that. But, the notion that you can build something and then have it in front of this audience of millions and millions of people almost overnight really appealed to me. So that was kind of laid the groundwork for what I'm doing now.
What year was that you made that app?
That was actually 6 years ago now. That was in March of 2007.
So right around then, I visited Cuba and I took... I think I was, if I wasn't the first person to use Twitter from Cuba, I was one of the very first. And mm-hmm. I actually was able to get it posting from walking around Cuba. And like I had a whole lot of people following me because of that.
That's funny. Yeah. No, it's, that was a really interesting time because it unearthed for me the idea that there was this global network of people that, were interested in the same kinds of things and, that I was. And, we kind of take it for granted now that it's easy to connect to these kind of global communities around tech interests and whatnot and find a network of global entrepreneurs. But at that time, there really weren't that many good tools for doing that. And Twitter was one of the first kind of communities where you could see that start to develop. And so it was very useful for me building out my early network and, the notoriety that the Twitter Vision project got. It actually ended up in the Museum of Modern Art. Which I thought was crazy, and cool. But like all of that sort of led to me being able to build out this kind of massive global network that, led to like Geeks on a Plane and some of my involvement in TED and things like that that I'm sort of enjoying now. So it's been a good journey.
Cool. So you did that, and then I saw when you started then Shortmail, and Shortmail was your idea for being able to do short responses to email. And mm-hmm. I remember a post where you're like, oh, no, it's beginning again, and you'd started to get real traction, but it seems like that didn't quite take off. Like, what happened there?
Well, so it's, sort of a work in progress, honestly. Basically the idea of it was, we believe that a lot of the reasons why email – behaves the way it does and why people interact with it the way that they do is because of the way it was designed. And, you know, there's a lot of design constraints that go into email, many of which we don't consciously think about. But if you think about the idea that anybody can send you an email at no cost to them, and in fact it puts kind of a cost on you to have to process it, there's some basic asymmetries in how that works. And so we thought, well, you know, what if we were to create a platform where we could experiment with some of the design parameters of email? And one of the most interesting things that we thought would be worth playing with was just the idea of message length. I know in my own experience that, you know, if I receive a short, concise email, I'm much more likely to respond to it quickly than I am to somebody sending me a, you know, multi-page long essay about their new idea and what they're going to do and all this. So I thought, well, maybe that would be a really simple way of changing behavior and overcoming email overload. And we rolled out the product and got a lot of press for it. And there's a lot of legitimate kind of interest in the concept. And, you know, we've got a couple hundred thousand users and it's, you know, continuing to grow on a daily basis. The challenge that we face right now is that because the internet is the internet, you know, there's issues with spam and people trying to do DOS attacks and things like that. So we're managing to survive all that. But to be honest, you know, in a small company where we've got sort of, you know, only so much bandwidth, we kind of can only focus on one thing at a time. So we're focused primarily on Mailstream right now. And, you know, while Shortmail is fine and continuing to grow, we want to go back and do some further refinements on that to kind of tighten up the concept a little bit more and then also take out some of the spammers and people who are trying to abuse it, which just kind of, you know, lowers the utility for everyone.
So Shortmail has a couple of hundred thousand users.
Yeah, yeah.
Are these active accounts or are these just, I mean, signups?
There's a lot of active users. You know, I'd have to actually, you know, go study the graphs to tell you exactly, you know, what the active user count is right now. But, you know, there's a lot of people that are really engaged with it. And, you know, we've got a mobile app and, you know, web-based application and whatnot. But, you know, as I said, there's just a lot of people that are, you know, you set up anything new that involves the ability to create new accounts, you're going to end up a spammer. So we've been fighting that. And to really do that well, we need to go back and do another layer and probably do like two-factor authentication.
That sucks.
Yeah, you know, which does suck, but that's the world we live in.
So how does it work? Like if I'm really excited about an idea and I send you a 20-page email about it to your Shortmail address, what happens then?
Yeah, so basically you'll get a response back and says that that's just too long and you need to edit that down to 500 characters. You get a link to go do that. And you can either do that or not, but if you don't do it, there's a pretty good chance I'm not going to see it. We do actually store the longer mail in a quarantine folder that, you know, you can choose to go and forward on or read or whatever. But, you know, to be honest, that is not something I usually do with that address. What I do a lot with, you know, Shortmail is publish that in places where I want to be able to publish like an email address, but I don't necessarily want, you know, spammers and I don't want people to abuse it. So I know that if they send something to that, anything that makes it through to me has to be short and concise. And I also put it on my blog as like a widget so that people can contact me that way. And it's actually really nice. You know, the inquiries that I get through that channel are always quite actionable and easy to understand. And, you know, and my response time is quicker as a result.
What's the behavior of people? Are they, so this is your effectively your public-facing email address, right?
Yeah, and one of the things that we were thinking about with it was that people could use it, you know, who have like a large public-facing presence, like a celebrity or a well-known personality or something, you know, could have something like this be up and available. But, you know, they would know that whatever came in through that channel would be concise and clean and easy to deal with.
So what percentage of the mail that comes in do people, when people email that, like, is it 90% of the time they get sent that message that tells them to go down and shorten what they've been saying?
It really depends on how the address has been publicized. Like in my case, you know, I publicize it, you know, often with like, you know, short emails maybe sent here or, you know, use this widget. So the widget already has a character counter built into it. The Sparrow mail program, which was big on the Mac for a while, had a character counter for short mail built into it. So we were trying to get, you know, those sorts of character limitations more built into the DNA of email. It's a long-term sort of prospect to get something like that out there. But we do think that there's something that really resonates there because, you know, we got just massive global attention around the concept. And so there's a pony in there. We just got to kind of work a little bit to unleash it, I think.
So, because this is what I want to ask you about before we then go on to what you're currently working on, because it seems to me like email is just one of those things, and trying to fix it and make a company out of fixing it is like generally a really bad idea and isn't going to make any money. You would obviously, you're voting very differently with your feet. I mean, and the Hotmail guys, I mean, they did well a long time ago. But, I mean, emails, it's just the amount of user resistance that you have to overcome. I mean, how many email accounts are there in the world, you know? Like, it seems like it's a difficult thing to fix.
it's definitely a minefield. And, you know, I have to say that a lot of our motivation, you know, to attack this is really just to try to advance, you know, the art of it and to... you know, try to somehow or another get a bite on some of these very intractable problems. I think, you know, everybody is using email these days. There's really nobody that's engaged in the information economy that's not on a daily basis dealing with email in some form. And the real truth of the matter is that there's a great deal of pain out there about how people are using it and the platforms that they're using and the solutions. And that pain is largely going unaddressed, and people have developed coping mechanisms for, you know, big chunks of it. And a lot of people defend those coping mechanisms as being, you know, sort of the least lesser of several evils, or, you know, the most sustainable way to, you know, survive a war, you might put it something like that. But, you know, I think that, you know, in general, there's just so many different problems. They're not solved. And yeah, you know, I think, you know, it can be difficult to make money in this space, but at the same time, I think a lot of that is because the visions that people have taken on have been fairly timid and maybe not always driven by really listening to users. I think that, you know, we've spent a tremendous amount of time, particularly with Maelstrom, just really listening to users and getting a sense of what it is that their pain points are, what they're likely to do, what they're not likely to do, so that we can move a little bit beyond what I would call like sort of the left-handed widget makers, you know, who work on Thursdays problem, where, you know, people who, if you try to build something for a very specific, you know, a tiny subset of the population, then you're going to get some, you're only going to be able to address that very tiny subset of the population as a total market size. And while there's like a 3.5 billion person, you know, global email market, you know, if you start to segment that down too much, you quickly get into, you know, like 100,000 person markets, which is why some of these tools, I think, while they're good, have failed to really both take off and to make money because they're just limited to too small a segment of the market. So yeah, with Maelstrom, we're very much focused on trying to keep the widest possible swath of the market open to us.
So so before we go on to Maelstrom, just on short mail, because it's interesting. I followed you on Twitter and I didn't really get the use case of being able to make that a publicly facing email address and therefore a short one. Something interesting happened a few weeks ago. There was a domain I was interested in buying, and I found the guy that owned it, and the easiest way to contact him turned it out to be on Facebook. Mm-hmm. And so I'm like, okay, I'll send him a message to see if he wants to sell me his domain. And so I go to message the guy, and Facebook says, you have never contacted this person before. If this message is sent to him, it will go into his, I think it's called an outbox. It wasn't going to go into his inbox in right. Facebook. Would you like to pay $1 to have it delivered into his inbox?
Right.
And, you know, like I'm about to, you know, see if I can buy a domain. So, of course, I'll pay the dollar. And, you know, we had a chat back and forth about it, and he wanted more than I was willing to pay. And so we left it at that. But it was a really good transaction. And so I guess that's one example of a little bit the sort of stuff you're doing with Shortmail.
Yeah, and in fact, we came up with that idea, you know, a couple years ago around, like, pay for your attention. So, like, the idea being, like, if you want to be at the top of my inbox, then you need to outbid everybody else, right? You know, now, granted, that's sort of probably a bit hard to pull off in practice. So I think Facebook is just kind of starting with a simple, let's just try it with a dollar and see what happens. There's a lot of different ways that you can experiment with these ideas. And I feel like that some of the things that we're doing, you know, have contributed to kind of the dialogue that's taking place in the marketplace around email too. So, you know, things like Mailbox in some ways seem a little bit inspired by some of the things we did with Shortmail. And that's totally cool. You know, like I think, we're interested in advancing these problems and we're going to get paid one way or the other along the way here. Being able to just drive things forward, I think is really fun.
Well, I was ecstatic to pay a dollar to get into this guy's inbox because it was totally worth it for me. I wasn't going to have to scrounge around and try and find more email addresses for him and engage. So it was every party in that interaction won. It was good.
Yeah, no, and I think that's the other thing we're going to see is that these other modes are going to start to, sort of break off and allow these kinds of exchanges to happen through all kinds of different channels, whether it's, you know, Twitter, Facebook, you know, different email platforms, whatever. People are going to communicate through whatever is the lowest resistance for them at that time.
Hmm. So tell us about Maelstrom.
Yeah, so Maelstrom is a little bit different concept. And, you know, rather than kind of saying, hey, let's do something really kind of totally new and different, let's just see if we can kind of make the existing email landscape a little bit better. And so basically, I don't know how many emails are in your inbox right now, but, there's a lot of people who have, 1,000 emails in their inbox, 10,000 emails. Some people never remove anything from their inbox and just, you know, let everything kind of flow past them and then search for what they need and respond to only the stuff on sort of the top page and whatnot. And that's kind of what I was saying earlier, in that there's so many different strategies that people have evolved to cope with email. There's a wide range of kind of what's normal. So anyway, that said, anybody who like goes on vacation for a week at this point comes back to find hundreds of emails in their inbox, possibly thousands. And, we felt like that the existing tools for just sort of managing that heavy flow of inbound email were really pretty inadequate and very unimaginative in terms of, how they work and what could be done. So with Maelstrom, what we did was just kind of focus on the fundamental insight that there's no such thing as kind of just like one message a lot of the time. It's very much about bundles of messages. So, if you have 20 emails from, say, your wife, or 50 emails from Groupon, or 30 emails from eBay, or 100 messages from Facebook notifications, or things from Twitter, those things can all be related together by way of their common sender or their common mailing list ID or, the subject line or what have you. And what we basically did was took a whole bunch of those fairly common ways of grouping messages together and made that super easy to do. So when you go into let's say you have 10,000 emails and you go into Maelstrom for the first time, you'll immediately see, the top senders that you have in that 10,000 messages grouped by, the most common one, which might be, 500, and the next common one would be 450 or something. And then you can quickly archive, delete, or label any of those bundles and take your 10,000 message inbox down to like 150 messages in just a few clicks, really, because you're acting on kind of the large head of the email, and then it just kind of leaves the long tail that, actually requires your attention. So depending on email flows, we have users that use it every day. We have some users that use it once a week. We have some users that use it once a month. We have some users that use it after they come back from vacation. Some users that use it on like accounts that have gotten unruly for whatever reason. It's kind of the idea of a machete or a machine gun, kind of a prosthetic tool for a human to make better sense more quickly of a large flow of email information.
So, you know, I followed you on Twitter, and that's something that I didn't understand, and it sounds fascinating. And, you know, here am I, you know, wisely quoting that you can't improve on email, and I think you've described two very interesting ideas on this call that both do and are building with interesting in the existing infrastructure. Why aren't these combined, and are you going to end up like building this into an email app that you're going to then sell to Microsoft, and then you're going to start telling everyone to use Bing? Is that what's going to happen?
Well, I think that, you know, if that happens, it'll be a few years, because it's going to take some time to flesh all this out a little bit more. But I think, you know, what we're looking to do right now is, you know, all the things that we've built share some common underlying DNA in terms of technology and approach. So a lot of the things that we did and learned with Shortmail were directly applicable to Maelstrom. And our thought is, you know, let's just get really good at understanding the underlying technology of email and try to make some stuff that, you know, create a context in which we can make improvements to email. And so, you know, where we're kind of at right now is, you know, we're a small, you know, 5-person startup, you know, with a seed round of funding, et cetera. So we're in the process of raising a little bit bigger round of funding and feel like that, you know, with the things that we've done, we've at least demonstrated that, you know, we know the space, we can follow through and build things and make things that get some traction, and et cetera. And, you know, now the next step is going to be to take it to the kind of the next level and to build some stuff that's a little bit more, you know, scaled out and substantial and produces some revenue, et cetera. And, you know, at that point, then, you know, maybe there will be an opportunity to combine with, you know, some other company. But, you know, that's not a necessary outcome either. We'd really like to build something that's contributes to, you know, the body of knowledge on this, makes people's lives better. You know, at the end of the day, we kind of think if you can make email enough better, you actually will improve people's relationships. Because that's really what people do with email, at least email between people and people, is, you know, conduct relationships. And to the extent that we can help people respond more quickly and, you know, be more responsive, then we improve relationships, which strikes me as a worthy goal. So,
well, the way you do that is just to get people to not use email, but, you know, I guess that's not part of that conversation.
Yeah, well, you know, I think that may be well as true as well, but, you know, if we can even get people to better use email to get together in person, that can be great too.
Is there anything else you want to tell us about Maelstrom?
Just that it's, you know, kind of exciting. We spent a lot of time doing, you know, customer-driven development, which a lot of people talk about, and few people actually sit down and do. And we actually did a lot with user testing, having users come in live and, you know, watching them use the product. We did 17 rounds or so of surveying to try to figure out, you know, exactly, you know, how we could improve the product and where we were succeeding. And, you know, it seems to really have paid off, because now that we're starting to get some more traction for it with, you know, some press hits and things like that, people are just loving the product. And they're, you know, explaining to other people about how much they're loving the product, which is great. And, you know, we feel like we're really contributing to happiness in the world, which is a good thing.
Can you walk me through how that worked?
In terms of the customer development process?
Yeah, like that sounds really – I've just changed my religion to lean. I, you know, went through one of their workshops, and it was amazing. And I learned a lot of those sorts of techniques through direct response marketing, but that's just on the sales side, and I've never learned it on the product development side. And it was, like, incredible. And so I'd love to hear what you guys have been doing and how you've been applying.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, the current practice du jour in sort of the tech startup world is this idea of lean startup. And, you know, I think that people often say it without really thinking about what it actually means in practice. And, you know, the truth of the matter is that it's really rigorous and it's hard work. And I wouldn't say that we necessarily, you know, have subscribed to any particular ideology on it, but what I would say is that we were really rigorous around conducting just many, many, many rounds of experiments. And that's really what it boils down to at the end, is, you know, conducting experiments and seeing, you know, how your changes affect the outcome with users. And so, you know, what we kind of did, we had developed the basic concept for Maelstrom about a year and a half ago, and or almost 2 years ago now. And we kind of had put it on a shelf because there were some technical issues that we knew we needed to sort out before we could return to it. So we got started with it again last year. And we thought, you know, rather than kind of go build it out to within an inch of its life, which is a little bit more of what we had done with Shortmail, we just thought, let's just kind of throw it out to a community of people and see kind of what reactions we get about different aspects of it and just get a baseline read. And there were some, you know, pretty serious technical problems with it that we knew existed, but, you know, it wasn't going to be worth going and fixing everything until we knew a little bit more what direction to take it in. And so we just put it out there and literally sent it to some mailing lists of some people who are affiliated with some of the investors that we work with and said, you know, here, kick the tires on this thing and tell us what you think and then fill out the survey. And the early survey results were like brutal, you know, just awful. You know, people were like, wow, this is the worst product I've ever seen, and, you know, horrible idea, terrible execution, you know, it looks ugly, you know. It was like,
so actually, just before you go on, like, how did you get these users to even go through that? Like, I mean, people don't like just filling stuff in. Like, what was their motivation?
So, you know, as I mentioned, we have some investors, including 500 startups and True Ventures, and so each of them maintains kind of founder community mailing lists where, you know, you can just kind of participate in conversations with other founders and get feedback and whatnot. So we started there, as well as some family and friends and local people and just people that were willing to kind of go through our painful process and, you know, had them just kick the tires on it and tell us what they thought. And so,
and so they did.
Oh, and they did. And they were absolutely brutal in their responses, which was great, you know, because it gave us a very clear idea of what specifically about, you know, the concept needed work, what specifically around the execution and the design needed work. And so then we just started going, okay, well, systematically, how do we start overcoming these objections? And, you know, the other thing that we did was brought in users to come in live and try it. And one of the things that you learn with that you don't learn from doing kind of online testing is, you know, people who have a bad experience online, as you say, they're just going to kind of drift away and they're not going to really give you any feedback. And so, you know, the people that have a great experience, they're going to send you an email that reinforces kind of your own biases around the product. But you're never going to hear that really brutal, you know, this doesn't make any sense for me. You know, I don't use email this way. I don't do this. I don't do that. You know, what happened when I clicked on this? It didn't work on my Windows PC, you know, whatever it is. You're just not going to hear a lot of that feedback. So what we found was really, really valuable was to do lunchtime sessions where we brought in, you know, just live users from out in the wild that we literally found on Facebook and stuff locally in some of our local tech groups and things, and just said, you know, hey, look, we're going to give you free pizza if you come in and try this, and it'll help you clean up your email. It's going to be great. So they would come in, and we would have our engineering team sit and watch the users as they try to use the software that they built. And there is nothing more humbling to an engineer or an architect, you know, to look at what people actually go through when they try to use your stuff and all the things that you think, you know, should be obvious and should be intuitive and whatnot turn out just not to be. And people really struggle. And, you know, these are not stupid people either. These are people that are familiar with technology and use technology products all the time. But, you know, in order to kind of divorce yourself from the biases that we all carry around kind of our own products and also just sort of how we think things should work, it's nothing more valuable than just watching people use a product. So, you know,
since you brought that up, this is something I've been thinking about a lot recently. I had some drinks with a guy from a Fortune 500 company a couple of weeks ago, and he was telling me how we need product management, that developers are not able to do things by themselves. They need an advocate to speak for the customer. Right. And I was saying, well, look, Facebook's telling us that they have all their developers were interfacing directly with users, and they build stuff and they try it, and if it doesn't work, then, you know, they have to redo it, and Facebook only hires great developers. And I've actually just published an interview with a guy who lives in the Caribbean. He manages 100 servers with 500 to 800,000 visitors per day on a viral loop, and all of their guys are also customer facing. And I'm starting to see that around more and more, that people who work on teams have to be able to interface with the users exactly as you're describing, because it makes them better. I'm curious as to your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think that that's really true. I think the notion that developers are somehow or another, you know, living on some rarefied place where they don't have to interface with users directly is kind of an anachronism. And one of the things that we're doing right now is, you know, we have kind of a team email address that we use for the product. And while, you know, I consider myself to be maybe nominally, you know, a product manager, and I know my partner feels the same way as well, but, you know, our team is getting all the emails that come from customers. So when customers email in praise, the team sees it. When they email in complaints, the team sees it. And to me, that just really grounds the whole process because, you know, we're able to say, like, look, you know, while, you know, we may think we've nailed some particular issue or, you know, have a design exactly right, you know, here's what the users are saying. And it's, you know, maybe mostly positive, but maybe not all positive. What can we do as a team to make that better? And so, you know, granted, we're a small team, and I don't know how you exactly totally scale that up. And I think, you know, bringing it into a big company like Facebook, you know, where you have a lot of different layers of complexity and maybe even some more mechanisms for managing, you know, rolling out stuff and testing it and doing A/B testing and stuff. But, you know, regardless, I think everybody is kind of, you know, an advocate for the customer. They kind of have to be. And I think the main job of like a management type role in that equation is just to make sure that the developers are getting enough direct contact with customers, whether that's in person or, you know, via email or what have you.
Is there anything else you want to tell us about Maelstrom? Because I have another big topic I want to ask you about.
Yeah, so just Maelstrom, it's growing like crazy. You know, we got some press in like Lifehacker about 5 weeks ago, 4 weeks ago, and that's taken off just dramatically. So it's like a 525% growth in like 5 weeks. You know, we've, I think as of this moment, helped people clear out about 105 million emails from their inboxes, which is pretty cool. And we're just excited to kind of see what's next with it. It kind of has the air of a product that's got a nice hockey stick curve going for it, and we want to see how far we can take it.
And you wouldn't – I mean, it would seem like a no-brainer to just combine it with Shortmail, or are those two different teams?
We actually – it's the same team that built both. And, you know, we might combine them down the road. For now, they're interoperable because you can use Maelstrom with Shortmail because it interfaces over IMAP and whatnot. But you know, it's something we might consider in the future for sure.
Okay, so what I want you to tell me about is, for me, a very interesting topic, is Baltimore. Now, some people will be here who aren't very familiar with Baltimore, especially if you don't live in the US, but Baltimore isn't really very known as being one of the most beautiful places to live in the US, and apologies for that, Dave, but I have been there, and so, you know, I know it's still a work in progress in some ways, but you're someone that is really pushing the tech community in Baltimore, and actually almost more than just about anyone else, I see you as a person very focused on, I don't know whether I'd say internet civics, but it's very interesting, and so I'm really interested to hear your thoughts on what you've been doing.
Yeah, sure. So, you know, for those who don't know, Baltimore is a major city in the U.S. It's located about 30 miles to the northeast of Washington, D.C., and it's about 640,000 people in the city proper. It is the birthplace of the telegraph, the railroad, a lot of different technologies over the years, home of Johns Hopkins University, probably the best hospital in the world. And so, you know, it's a major city and a major megalopolis. I mean, if you consider the sort of market that runs between Washington, D.C. and New York City, you know, we're right in the middle of it. And, you know, you're talking about tens of millions of people in that, you know, combined market. And so it's difficult to talk about, you know, Baltimore without putting it into the context of being in kind of this major East Coast corridor, you know, that includes, you know, all of the federal government and the National Security Agency, which is right down the road here. So the fact of the matter is that the Maryland, Baltimore, Washington metro area has, you know, highest concentration of PhDs of anywhere in the world. And Maryland as a state is the highest income state in the union. So, you know, there's a lot going on here to recommend the place. And for those of you that, you know, have seen The Wire, you know that there's also a problem with, you know, drugs and crime and, you know, corrupt politicians and whatnot. On the other hand, that problem is not limited to Baltimore alone. That also, you know, obviously affects Washington, D.C. and Philadelphia and New York and just about every major city in the United States. So, you know, I think that in some ways Baltimore gets a little bit of a bad rap through some of these media depictions and whatnot. On the other hand, it's only thanks to The Wire that people can spell Baltimore and much of the developed world. So I think that we have kind of a love-hate relationship with The Wire. And honestly, you know, I think Baltimore takes it as a certain point of pride that, you know, while this, you know, it has sort of this negative reputation as a result of that TV show, it is at least one of the best TV shows that's been ever made. So
it is a great TV show.
Yeah. So, you know, we take that with some pride. But and I should point out that I'm not actually from Maryland or Baltimore. I was born in Southern California and moved to the Maryland area when I was a small kid. And my parents settled here. And, you know, I just kind of grew to fall in love with the place and understand its history and understand kind of its contradictions and flaws and what makes it great, what makes it not so great. And just realize that there's just a tremendous amount of potential here that because, you know, kind of the history of the place has led to people being rather self-deprecating about it, there's kind of a sort of a tragic humility around the place where people just kind of want to assume that, you know, oh, we're not that great, you know, whatever. And so nobody here really toots their own horn. But the bottom line is that there's all kinds of really cool stuff to celebrate and a lot of really great people. And, you know, because of our colleges and universities and because of, you know, just the all the industries and whatnot that are located in the area, there's also a lot of smart tech that's happening here as well. And so I've just been doing what I can to, you know, seed efforts here for others. I've been doing some angel investing. I started a group called Baltimore Angels that does angel investing here in this market. And, you know, have started a co-working facility. So have helped to seed a lot of business relationships that way, which, you know, now there's multiple co-working facilities in the city. As you mentioned, started to do some civic journalism type work, you know, prompting people to use the internet as a way to organize around topics that, you know, might not otherwise get too much attention. So using Facebook and Twitter, things like that to do civic stuff. And, you know, really just dig in and use all the tools that we have to make this a great place. I mean, I think for me, you know, I was sort of offered the option when I was, you know, in my early 20s back in the 90s to, you know, move out to San Francisco and be part of kind of the first wave of the internet boom. And I seriously considered it. But something about me just didn't feel like it was right for me. And I kind of realize now that probably if I have a mission in life, it's to bring the Silicon Valley mindset to places like Baltimore by way of example and just plain doing it, as opposed to, you know, being a follower and trying to go where it's easy. I think that it's a little bit more interesting and maybe a little bit more courageous, although, you know, that remains to be seen, to try to, you know, be an instigator of that kind of culture in a place that is kind of on the brink of a lot of greatness all by itself. So
what, I mean, the internet is making things more distributed. 3D printing is starting to gain traction, and you know how that's going to work. Who knows? How does a space like Baltimore fit into these sorts of things? It would, you know, are we going to need cities more or less as things go forward? You know, if Bitcoin takes off and all of these other things that are happening.
Yeah, I mean, I think where I've come to understand the place of cities is that mathematically, they really provide a lot of potential in the form of kind of weak ties relationships between people, and I'll explain what I mean by that. I mean, the idea is that let's suppose that, you know, you grew up in a really small town in the middle of nowhere, and you're a promising young, I don't know, you know, comp sci person or a physicist or whatever, or an author or really anything that involves any specialty whatsoever. And you want to try to find like-minded souls to go and converse with and to bounce ideas around off with and to learn with. That's really, really hard most of the time in small places because, you know, your circle of friends is limited and, you know, the circle of friends of your circle of friends is fairly limited. But in a city environment, you know, you have this opportunity to kind of find people through, you know, if you can't find them in your first immediate relationships, then you can maybe find them through second tier relationships. And if you can't find them that way, maybe you'll see a poster, or maybe you run into them on the street, or maybe you'll go to a seminar, or maybe you'll see them at the library, or maybe you'll bump into them at the grocery store or whatever. It's this kind of high density environment that I think leads to a lot of innovation and growth. And so I think in that regard, cities are kind of the bedrock for the future of innovation and building new ideas and whatnot. That said, I think I found it really interesting that Marissa Meyer's recent edict about Yahoo people not working from home got so much traction in terms of people getting wound up about it. If you think about it, what she's really trying to do is to encourage people at Yahoo to, you know, be in the office, be together, to promote those kinds of weak ties and relationships and the serendipity of bumping into somebody in the hallway. And, you just can't do that if people are distributed all over the place and working from home and distracted with other things. And, you know, I don't see it as a zero-sum game between, like, the physicality of being near others versus like telework and working from home. I think working from home can be totally valid, and I've done it many, many times in my life. But when it comes time to do like ideation and group collaboration and creativity, there's really nothing that beats, you know, being near and interacting with other people on an ongoing basis. And I think that that's what she's really trying to emphasize with that policy. I think that the place for telework comes in when, you know, it's kind of like you have a clearly defined task where, you know, you need to build a thing that does this by this date and it needs to work this way, and leave me alone. I just want to go in the corner with my head down and actually finish this. And it's this kind of singular solitary work, you know, or, you know, other types of work that might be adaptable to that might be like answering trouble tickets or responding to emails or something like that. But, you know, it's kind of a dichotomy, you know, and there's a yin and yang to it. You can't have people there. You are not going to create jobs for people that can just go off in the corner with their heads down and work from home unless you have people coming together in a creative mode to do that. So it's kind of a long way of trying to answer your question. I think, cities play a crucial role in ideation because they provide a platform for people to collaborate and coexist together and to experience that kind of serendipity together.
I have some more questions to ask you, but we're almost out of time. Do you have more time?
Yeah, I have a few more minutes.
I've seen you on Twitter. You periodically get into little discussions with your local newspapers, and I was curious if you want to tell us a little bit about that.
Our local newspaper is the Baltimore Sun. It's owned by the Tribune Company. The Tribune Company has been in bankruptcy since 2008, and there's been a lot of speculation about, really what the future of the Baltimore Sun may or may not be. And so I guess starting in 2009, I started to host some sessions with people interested in the topic, you know, from the media, from radio, print, and television locally, to try to understand kind of what might be possible and what the future of the paper might be. And, since then, I guess Tribune is starting to unwind its bankruptcy situation. There's discussion now about, you know, selling off those newspaper properties. Rupert Murdoch, the Koch brothers, other people seem to be named as potential buyers. And, my position on it is very much that, it doesn't make sense to purchase the existing legacy newspaper just because, you know, you're really talking then about getting all this pile of assets that you probably don't want, which includes things like real estate and printing presses and labor, you know, situations and all kinds of ongoing obligations. To me, it would make more sense to create like a well-funded startup that, you know, was willing to kind of do some agile experimentation. And then, you know, potentially maybe cherry pick off some of the assets from the Sun that would be interesting, such as the brand name or, you know, maybe some of the, you know, staff or what have you. But fundamentally, I really am pretty bearish on the newspaper industry just because, genetically, you know, they've been kind of selecting for people that don't know how to make money at this for a long time. And, you know, the notion that you're going to be able to somehow or another fashion a team of people that can reinvent this out of the existing group of folks and the culture that they have just strikes me as extremely unlikely. Not to say impossible, and, you know, certainly with the right leadership, anything is possible, I suppose. But it just strikes me as, you know, it's going to take tens of millions to hundreds of millions of dollars to bring the sun back to some kind of sustainability. Wouldn't it be better just to dump that kind of money into a startup and move forward in a new mode with a new culture, new team, new mindset, and really new DNA around the problem? Because, yeah, the old way isn't working.
I bet you're not making friends by saying that sort of stuff.
Well, there's people that do find it true, and so those people, yeah, they agree with me. There's people at the Sun certainly that are not happy to hear that, but I have to call it like I see it, you know. And again, I mean, I don't have any vested interest in this because I'm, you know, I'm not a media person, but I would be willing to help to put together a team around a startup to solve these problems, because, you know, in the end, we really do need a civic news organization to go out and find stories, figure out what's going on with government, do government oversight, and, you know, it isn't going to happen just on its own. We have to actually plan for that. So I think at some point that need will arise, because, you know, potentially the paper will just be unable to do it, at which point I'm willing to stand up and help lead the charge. But I'm very much willing to wait until that time happens as well.
Cool. Well, I think that's actually everything I wanted to ask you. So is there anything else you wanted to add in?
No, I think that sounds pretty good.
All right. Well, thank you very much for the interview.
Hey, thank you, Adrian.